Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm super excited for this week's show because we are going to boldly go where no one has gone before. That's right, we're talking about Star Trek First Contact. I am joined for this conversation by my number one, Rob DiCristina.
Hey Patrick, you know who I'm really excited to talk to at this year's F This Movie Fest?
Who's that?
Dog. Thought about that joke all day.
It works for any song. You just change the lyrics to Doug.
Hi, Doug.
I still do that to this day. We used to do it in high school. We would just change song lyrics to Doug, and I still do it.
Patrick is not as conducive a name to song lyric change.
No, it doesn't work.
It's very one-sided.
Yeah. It's a real bummer. But yes, I'm glad you brought up F This Movie Fest because just this week we announced it is taking place on March 7th, Woo! 2020, beginning at 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. That's 2 hours earlier than it used to be because we've added for the second year in a row a sixth movie. This year we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of 1990 by watching six movies from 1990, kicking things off with Tremors. Then the original 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, followed by Dick Tracy, which will be fun for you and Adam because there's so much Pacino in that movie. Followed by Hard to Kill, one of two movies Steven Seagal made in 1990. And I'll tell you, I chose Hard to Kill because William Sadler is in it, and I thought maybe we could trick him into tweeting along with us as opposed to Marked for Death. I don't know. Anybody on Twitter that's in Marked for Death. Keith David, maybe? I don't know if he's on Twitter. And then Darkman, and closing things out with Total Recall.
This is an excellent lineup, Patrick, and I want to know, or I want to insist now, that six movies be the norm from here on out, because Adam and I were talking about this, and you were sort of floating the idea of repeating it. Because last year was sort of a special thing when you added the sixth movie. It was a Tobe Hooper issue,
right?
And you sort of suggested that probably wouldn't happen every year. But now that it's back for a second year, I think everyone would agree with me.
Oh boy,
that it needs to start being six movies from now on.
Well, we noticed last year that six movies didn't really feel any different than five.
Not at all.
In terms of tweeting through them, you know, I'm sure for some people who are in other parts of the world, waking up 2 hours earlier is probably less fun.
I also think it gives everybody who's not in the room with us like more of an opportunity. Like a longer event means people can come in and out. People can join in earlier or leave earlier. You know, I think it gives, you know, we're all in the basement anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So, you know, I think more time gives more opportunity for more people. So yeah. I think that's always a good thing if we can get more movie love.
Well, I hope it's going to be a fun day. I hope everybody who's listening is able to participate. You just follow along the hashtag FThisMovieFest and tweet your way through six movies. I think it's going to be a good day.
It's going to be a great day, Patrick. I can't wait.
This is the ninth one. Can you believe it?
That's pretty crazy. This will be my fourth that I've attended.
Yeah.
My fifth that I've sort of participated in. The first year I sort of was watching it because I wasn't really a Twitter person then.
Okay.
And then the year before I joined the site, I was participating a lot. And then the last 4 years I've done it from HQ.
Yeah, it's great having you here.
It's always fun.
So we're going to talk about Star Trek First Contact. But first, Rob, have you seen anything good lately?
I think I have. I need to get this right though, because there's been a name change to the first movie I want to talk about because people are stupid. I saw over the weekend Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which I'm going to insist is the title. This is an Edge of Tomorrow situation, but almost in reverse because the better title is the original one. And I really liked Birds of Prey quite a bit. It's a huge mess. There's lots of little dips and so on, but Margot Robbie is just having the time of her life with that character, and you know, far be it from me to deny her that. I think it's really fun. Somebody on Twitter I think described it as kind of like an acid trip Goodfellas kind of thing, and love that the first act is basically just a pursuit of a bacon, egg, and cheese. I had a lot of fun with it. I thought it was really, really If you ask me right now to put on one DCEU movie that I just, you know, throw it on randomly, I would probably go with Birds of Prey.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I thought it was very entertaining. You know, I thought at first some of the weird narrative somersaults that it was doing were distracting me, but then I realized that that's part of the gag. And because, again, we're watching the movie through the prism of Harley Quinn as the narrator, basically. So, of course, it's going to be all out of order and it's going to double back on itself and forget certain details that then it throws in. I thought the action was handled really well. The photography is really great. I thought every performance in the movie seems to be having a lot of fun. If I have one nitpick, there's a really funny joke with Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character. The way that she's chosen to play it and the way that she's written that I almost wish we got more of, because the joke almost doesn't land just because there's not enough time for it to develop.
Yeah.
But I thought the gag of her being like awkward when she tries to like do cool superhero shit, I thought was very funny.
Yeah. I know the joke you're talking about. It does sort of narrowly avoid the rule of threes. Like it kind of comes up. I think it actually does. It comes up twice. Right. And then it doesn't pay off that third time maybe. Yeah. But, Ewan McGregor seems to be having the time of his life, which was really fun. And I wanted to just speak to what you said about seeing it through Harley's perspective. I really like, you know, I mean, I want to be sort of douchey about it, but I like that Harley has more agency in this movie. I like that it incorporates a lot of her actual like psychoanalysis of her enemies and stuff like, and the way she sort of throws it away. Like, and she sort of speaks to McGregor's character as, you know, here's your insecurities. And she sort of just throws them away because in the end they don't matter because she's lost her mind. I really, really had fun with it. I thought it was, it's, you know, I don't know, we don't have to get into box office bullshit, but it's a shame that they're going to the lengths to kind of corral people to see it because it's totally worth it.
It is. And, you know, I guess it opened lower than they were hoping because it cost something like $85 million and it opened to $35 domestic, but like around $80 worldwide. So it basically made its budget back. I know that doesn't cover marketing costs. But that is only in its first weekend. I don't know. It's being dismissed as this disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to necessarily say it has to do with it being a female director or an almost entirely female cast. I don't know if that's why it's sort of being treated differently than other movies of the same performance. But it is disappointing the way that the narrative is being spun that this movie is a letdown, because I think it's really good.
I want to throw one thing out there. It's only February, but I'm thinking about the end of the year. I'm going to posit, and I'll find out if I'm right in a few months, that the Harley Quinn tossing Black Canary a hair tie moment will make your movie moments of the year.
It might. It's pretty great. There's a lot of really fun moments, though.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot. It's fun. It's a good movie. Birds of Prey is a good movie, folks. Go see it.
It is. I mean, this year we've already had Underwater, we've had Birds of Prey, we've had Color Out of Space. This weekend we get VFW. There's a lot of good shit this year so far.
Speaking of Underwater, which I still have not seen, unfortunately, but I did read a rumor or something, or an article that about Kristen Stewart was supposed to play Barbara Gordon in the original draft of Birds of Prey, but then the role was cut, and I guess maybe she was busy or something, but that would have added a little extra something. But
it's the only thing that would have made the movie better.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know what's really funny is, you know, we've both seen Charlie's Angels, and I think we sort of agree that she's kind of in her own movie.
Yeah,
and it feels like maybe she's in this movie. She's just not actually on the set.
They could just digitally remove her from Charlie's Angels and insert her Forrest Gump style into Birds of Prey. I think we've got something.
It's the only thing that would make the movie better. I did also finally get around to Dr. Sleep. Which I wrote about last week,
so
into too much, but, you know, I love a sequel that doesn't fuck with the original, especially something that is so beloved as The Shining. I think it added a really interesting dimension to The Shining. I have not read either book, unfortunately. My Stephen King is not where it should be. I need a little bit more Stephen King in my life, but, obviously seen and loved The Shining, and I really enjoyed Dr. Sleep a lot. Another Ewan McGregor film. He's kind of on a roll this year.
Yeah, well, last year. Did you watch the theatrical cut?
Yeah, I watched the theatrical cut. I got it from the Red Box. So, did you watch the director's cut
yet? I have not yet, because I haven't picked up the disc yet, so I have not yet seen the director's cut. Right. I really want to.
how does the, and I know you've probably covered this before, but how does the movie compare to the book?
I haven't read the book.
Ah,
I'm a garbage human being. So I wanted to reread The Shining before I read Dr. Sleep, before I saw the movie.
Got it.
And instead, I was halfway through The Shining when Dr. Sleep came out. So I am still going to get to it, but I have not yet read the book.
Next movie I want to hit is, I was texting you and Adam a couple weeks ago, low-budget kind of sci-fi movie called Code 8, which I actually do want to bring up. I mentioned to you guys that it was kind of like Looper meets Dread in a Redbox. It's by
which
no means...
sold me, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And Han from Fast and Furious is in it. And
double sexy, sold.
Sexy Arrow guys, the Amell brothers, I think is how you say, Robbie and... what's Green Arrow's name? Stephen Amell.
Okay.
They apparently co-wrote it or had some intense involvement in it because they were also in the short film version of it. So Code 8 is really derivative. As I said, Looper meets Dread in a red box. It's pretty cheap, but it's got enough energy to be entertaining. And, you know, I don't always think that, like, I think there is a strength in playing genre tropes, not necessarily inverting them or subverting them, but playing them straight, but also playing them honestly. I think sometimes when we play genre tropes, really no matter what the genre is, sometimes they're played in a way where it feels like the movie just sort of resigns to the fact that it has to do it. Like, all right, well, this is the part of the romantic comedy where they break up and then they're going to find a way to get back together. Or, you know, this is the part where they do this or that. But I don't want to oversell it, but I think Code 8 does the traditional genre stuff in a really, like, it does it with a lot of energy, and that to me kind of endeared me to it. And there's some creativity in there. It doesn't always go exactly the way you think. So certainly nothing mind-blowing, certainly nothing, you know, to be a strong recommend or anything. But if you're flipping around on Amazon Prime and it's like 2 a.m. and you want something like, you know, you just finished watching Hard to Kill and you want something kind of mindless, Code 8, you could do a lot worse than Code 8.
How did you arrive at it?
I was, my stepdad picked it out. I was up at my mom's and he likes a lot of, you know, he looks a lot of sci-fi stuff, a lot of history stuff. And, he just randomly put it on. I kind of sat down and watched it with him and I was like, hey, you know, this is not bad. So it's not bad.
Nice.
That's all I'll say about it. Not going to go crazy. Not going to go crazy with the recommendation. It's not going to change anybody's life, but.
What is the basic premise of Code 8?
So the basic premise of Code 8 is basically that, there is, like Looper, a certain percentage of the population that's mutants, basically, and they have certain powers. And the and society has basically risen. It's almost like if X-Men. It's like the X-Men universe. If the humans integrated mutants into everyday life, and they got jobs as like contractors, like the electricity guy can like really do a lot of wiring really well for cheap and stuff like that. And it's essentially just a guy trying to raise himself up out of poverty and save his mother who's got cancer. So he gets in with this gang of other superpowered guys, and they it kind of becomes a heist movie at certain points. But then there's a lot of, you sort of slowly discover what some of their powers are through the plot and some twists in the plot, not necessarily just, you know, a scene where they stand there and show off their powers and their costume. One in particular is a really, really strong plot point. There's a woman who can heal people and she's kind of an empath as well. And that figures into the end of the movie in an interesting way. So like I said, it's nothing new, it's nothing crazy, but you know, if you're looking for a good sort of dystopian sci-fi with some X-Men thrown in there, you could do worse.
All right, cool.
Speaking of you can do worse, Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
Ah, yes.
We've both seen at this point, right?
Yeah.
It is the most inside Kevin Smith movie of Kevin Smith's career.
Which is saying something.
Which is saying something. I had a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun living in the world. It's by no means a great movie. It's barely a movie in some ways. The Affleck stuff, of course, speaks right to me. I love Chasing Amy. I love Ben Affleck. I love that he came back for this. And it's just, you know, it's, I was texting you and Adam, like, I just let Kevin Smith have fun. Like, it just, he's not hurting anybody. Like, I've read some reviews of this movie that are so incredibly just, like, just ripping it apart. And I still maintain that a lot of people around our age, you know, the 10, 15 year gap there, like, have this thing with Kevin Smith where we're so anxious to dismiss him because he was such a big part of who we are when we were growing up. And we're so eager to throw that part away and throw in the trash and say, no, I don't like that anymore. That's shit. We like art now. Kevin Smith maintains his course. Sometimes he tries to make super artsy stuff and then he goes back to the well, and that's okay. I would, it's another movie that I would really throw on kind of at any time. The meta Kevin Smith stuff starts to stretch a little bit, like when all of a sudden Kevin Smith is in the movie and it's right, like, all right, right, that's a little, but then again, like, I'm nitpicking in this movie and it's like all the movie wants to do is tell me that it's a movie. It's for completists only, but I'm a completist, so I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it went back to Chainsaw the Pop Strike Back maybe a little too often, because that's a 20-year-old movie at this point.
And it's not a movie I like that much. I actually really don't like Chainsaw the Pop Strike Back all that much.
Okay. I liked it in 2000. You know, it hasn't aged very well.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I watched it maybe the last time Doug was in town. We put it on, and it was like, oh, wow, this is a 90-minute gay panic joke.
I mean, yeah, I know, but it's
again, also, Kevin Smith is not a homophobe. I'm not suggesting he is, you know, I know that he is not. So it's odd that so much of the movie is a gay panic joke.
But I also like the adjustments that this one makes.
For sure. Yeah.
And it kind of does, you know, even though at first, at first when you're throwing the whole, oh, it's the reboot with diversity and stuff. And I was like, ooh, we're not doing this, are we? But then you see how it plays into the movie. You're like, oh, okay, well, that fits a little bit better, you know? And obviously I'm a sucker for Affleck's Amy story, and it wrecked me. And, it was a lot of fun.
That scene is very good.
Yeah.
Had I seen the movie in time, that would have made my list of favorite moments. And there's some good stuff with Jay and his daughter. Again, wishing for a different movie instead of appreciating the movie that it is, there's a lot of me that's like, boy, if you're capable of this stuff, couldn't you do more of it in the movie? And less of, maybe I just don't find some of his comedy as funny as I used to. And so therefore, I think the emotional stuff actually works. And it made me wish that there was more of that and less of the broad comedy.
And I'm wondering if that, you know, I've been thinking the last couple of years, because he's been trying so hard to get all these movies made. He tried to get Clerks 3 made and that didn't work out. And then he tried to get the Mallrats sequel made, and then it was going to be a series and that didn't work out. And I don't know if it was a creative thing or if it was financing, but I'm wondering if maybe he was able to sell this concept, like, oh, it's going to have Affleck and Jason Lee, right, and we're going to go on a road trip again and blah, 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 blah. And by the way, there's going to be an Avenger in it randomly. I won't spoil for anybody who's not seen it yet. Avenger is probably too much of a spoiler anyway, but it's certainly, you know, like I said, it's barely a movie, but
right,
if you're a Kevin Smith person, it's sprinkles on top of the ice cream. It's really good.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
That's it. All right. I have Birds of Prey. Erica and I watched Miss Americana on Netflix, which is the new documentary about Taylor Swift that just played Sundance and then showed up on Netflix like within the week. I'm not a Taylor Swift fan. I'm not a Taylor Swift fan. If one of her songs comes on the radio, it's often catchy and I can leave it on, but I don't buy her albums.
You have a favorite Taylor Swift song and you're going to tell us what it is.
Do I? I don't know if I do. My daughter's been listening to Shake It Off a lot, but not the actual version. She's been listening to this version that like people made on YouTube where they dress as Disney princesses and perform Shake It Off, but they changed the lyrics. Because my daughter's way into parody right now. She basically only listens to Weird Al.
Listen, we've all had a point in our lives where we're only listening to Weird Al. Rosie, I'm incredibly proud of you.
And it's always the same four songs, because she'll tell the Alexa, Alexa, play Weird Al, and it goes in the same order every time, it seems like. So it's basically four Weird Al songs that are running my life.
And they are.
Foil. Eat It.
Of course.
Word Crimes. And oddly enough, the theme to Captain Underpants from a couple years ago, which I forgot Weird Al wrote.
Wow. They were not the four I was thinking it would be.
No, those are the four that come up for some reason.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so yeah, Miss Americana, I think, is very much a piece of PR. It's very much, you know, a tribute to Taylor Swift being great. And I understand if people dismiss it as being that, but I also think it's better than just being that. I think it never ends up being tremendously revealing. It doesn't get into like the dark side of Taylor Swift. It touches on certain moments, but kind of skates right past them, like whether or not she was complicit in the whole Kanye thing a couple years back, which I barely even knew about until this documentary. But I also think it's an interesting look at what it's like to be that famous, to have that much pressure on you to be a role model, to be a pop star, to be a beautiful woman in the public eye, to maintain your artistic credibility. And she gives a really interesting speech late in the film about how women are required to reinvent themselves every few years, and you can only reinvent yourself so many times, whereas men are sort of allowed to, you know, the Rolling Stones, I think Erica pointed out, like, the Rolling Stones have been doing the Rolling Stones for 50 years, but Taylor Swift has to reinvent herself every 4 years. So there's interesting observations like that. I don't think anybody's going to come away with a great understanding of Taylor Swift, but I actually thought it was a pretty good documentary.
Was it, sometimes a lot of documentaries are centered around, like, a tour she's going on, or was this just they invited her, just, you know, come in the house and film me, or is she doing something?
I'm not sure. A lot of it kind of covers her early career until now, and then about halfway through the film, it shifts a little bit because it's right around the period where she sort of decided to speak up politically. She got involved in, I think, a Tennessee Senate race. And that was a big decision for her. And there's a scene where there's a table full of people that are basically just there to represent Taylor Swift. And I was like, how do you live a life when there's a table full of people making decisions about everything you should do, everything you should say, how you should look? A lot of people were against her being political because they saw what happened with the Dixie Chicks, and they know that you're going to alienate a bunch of your fan base if you do that. But it was something that was very important to her. So it kind of becomes a movie about the moment where that becomes a piece of her public persona.
I'm trying to think of my favorite Taylor Swift songs. I wasn't listening to any of that. I was looking through my Spotify here. If you asked me, I'd probably say Style off of 1989.
I don't know that one.
How You Get the Girl off of 1989.
I don't know that one.
The Way I Loved You off of Fearless.
Oh my gosh.
I do not mind me some Taylor Swift.
I guess not. I don't think I know these songs. I know Shake It Off.
I'm going to send them to you.
All right.
Reply in the comments with your top three T-Swizzle jams.
I appreciate that she writes her own music, you know, as a pop star on that level. I don't know how many of them still do.
I think there is a point in a, you know, and this is just mindless prognosticating, but like, I think there is a certain point in a celebrity's career where they, you kind of mentioned this with her saying that women have to reinvent themselves. They kind of have to make a choice, like, about who they're going to be for the second act or whatever of their career. For some reason, Robert Pattinson jumped into my head, you know, Robert Pattinson, who started as an idol and then is kind of going off and making all these really incredibly amazing smaller movies. And now, of course, he's going to be Batman, which will bring him more notoriety again. I feel like there's a choice that an artist makes. I think at this point, Taylor Swift has solidified herself enough where she's, not to say that the pressure is off, but she's got enough kind of agency that she can kind of make up her mind. And I hope she does interesting things because I think she's talented.
Yeah. I watched the new Hulu Into the Dark movie called My Valentine, which I haven't seen all of the Into the Dark movies. I've only seen a handful. You know, they release them once a month to sort of coincide with a holiday. My favorite thus far was All That We Destroy, which was last year's Mother's Day offering from previous guest of the show, Chelsea Stardust. This is obviously the Valentine's Day one. It is about a young woman who's an aspiring musician. We watched it right after the Taylor Swift documentary, which was kind of interesting because the two made sort of a fascinating, if unintentional, double feature. she's an aspiring musician she breaks up with her boyfriend, who was sort of her manager and collaborator. And he finds somebody new who he sort of makes in her image. So he gives her the look, he steals all her music, and this girl becomes the biggest pop star.
Wow.
And so then the first girl is still out performing the music and being accused of stealing from the pop star. It's like sort of needlessly complicated because it all starts there and it's throwing all this weird backstory at you. And you're like, what does this all matter? And it kind of does, but ultimately it leads to a showdown at a club with the boyfriend and the pop star and this girl. And it's really just about a bad relationship. It's about what a terrible human being this guy was and how abusive and manipulative and how he was gaslighting her. And, it's about just sort of this toxic relationship. It runs like under 80 minutes, and that's with like 4 music video interludes. So there's not a ton of substance there. It's very flashy. I think Maggie Levin was her name who wrote and directed it. The budgetary limitations definitely show because it's basically a movie set in one room. But she directs it with a lot of style. The music is actually pretty good. You could do worse.
Do you have a favorite of the Into the Dark movies? If I was going to check one out?
All That We Destroy.
All That We Destroy. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
all right.
That's a good one.
I've not seen any of these yet.
No, and the ones that I have seen have been kind of hit or miss.
Okay.
Then finally, before the Oscars, which I don't think we really need to talk about except to congratulate Parasite.
Woo!
And everybody who won, but especially Parasite, which had sort of a big night. Right before the Oscars, we finally caught up on A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood because I had missed it during awards season. And it was kind of the big nominee that we hadn't seen yet. Tom Hanks, of course, was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And to be honest, the first time I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, no, thank you. Because I just thought the casting of Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers seemed very obvious. And I was like, I'm not interested in a biopic about Mr. Rogers a year after that great documentary came out.
I was about to say that Won't You Be My Neighbor is what it's called, right? Was that what it was called? Won't You
Was
Be My
the
Neighbor?
Documentary, yeah.
Yeah. No, that was excellent, yeah.
It was very good, yeah. So I was like, I don't think I need this movie. But I was wrong. It's a really good movie, and Tom Hanks is pretty incredible in it. And it uses Mr. Rogers sparingly. It's not a biopic of Mr. Rogers. He's like a supporting character in the story of this journalist who's having some issues with a father who has reentered his life. And it uses Mr. Rogers as sort of a tool on how we should all treat each other, how we should all approach life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's
kind of a end of the tour kind of thing where it's not the same thing, but it's sort of using – it's not centered on the
right.
celebrity.
No, it's not, yeah.
That's interesting.
It's very much worth seeing, and I think it does a lot of really interesting stylistic things because it's sort of structured as an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood where he's introducing the story, and it's constantly cutting back to – the set that he used on the show. It does a lot of interesting things, the way it sort of interweaves the actual TV show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, with reality. It's surprisingly very well done.
That sounds excellent. I missed it too. And I totally missed an award season. I didn't get a screener. I missed the screening, and I kind of felt what you felt, which was like, it's probably what I think it is, but I'm happy to hear that it's not.
It's not. It's quite good.
It's kind of Rocket Man again, where it's sort of like you think it's going to be this one thing, and then it actually ends up being something much more interesting. So,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, I recommend it when it does hit, digital and DVD, which I'm guessing should be pretty soon.
I think any minute now.
Any minute. All right. Let's talk about Star Trek First Contact. I recently listened to the Screen Drafts podcast where they drafted all of the Star Trek films. And it was kind of a maddening experience to listen to, because that podcast often can be maddening to listen to. but it made me want to revisit all the Star Trek movies. And really, instead of doing that, I just started back watching Next Generation again from the beginning. I'm still only on season one, but I'm enjoying it a great deal. I have all these, you know, plans that, well, once I'm done with all of Next Generation, I'll go through all of Deep Space Nine and then through all of Voyager. And we're talking about 21 seasons of a TV show. And chances are I will tire out before then and need a break. So
chances are you won't get to Riker's beard.
I'll get to Riker's beard.
All right.
Don't you worry about that.
Will you get past Tasha Yar?
I'll probably get past Tasha Yar.
All right, then you're fine.
When does she leave?
That's like the end of the first season.
Oh, then I'll definitely get past Tasha Yar. Her unceremonious death.
Poor Tasha Yar.
Poor Tasha Yar. She wanted out, right? Didn't she ask to be?
Yeah, she wanted out to do. There was a movie that she did, and I can't remember what it is. But she wanted out to do movies. I can't remember what they were, but yes.
Okay, not Pet Sematary.
No, I don't think so. I think it was Pet Sematary is what, 89?
Pet Sematary is 89, so that would have been like.
This was pre Pet Sematary.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, I will get to Riker's beard, and I will get to Tasha Yar being killed off. I'm not positive how far into the series I will get. Hold on, I'm trying to read up on why she left. It just says...
I wasn't sure if I should vamp or...
No, you're fine. It just says she grew disillusioned with her role because of its Uhura-like status. She didn't get to do much, so she decided to leave the show.
Well, okay.
And she leaves in season 1, episode 22.
So she leaves before Beverly Crusher arrives, right?
No, Beverly Crusher's there from the beginning.
Who's the doctor before?
Oh, the other doctor.
There's another doctor.
Yes.
Right?
Who I'm not crazy about.
No, me neither. I was trying to remember if she and Crusher...
Crusher leaves for a little while and is replaced by...
That's right.
Oh, I can't remember her name, but I'm not a fan of her. I was happy when Crusher came back.
Yeah. No, it's all good.
But I was not watching Next Generation in the late 80s or 90s. I didn't come to it until much later. So when I went to see First Contact, I went to see it opening night with my girlfriend at the time, and neither of us were Star Trek fans. I mean, I had watched the original series growing up, but I was not watching Next Generation. So I sort of knew the characters a little bit just through pop culture osmosis, but I wasn't going to see it as a Next Generation fan. I just was going to see it because it was the big movie that was opening that weekend, and really enjoyed it even as a non-Star Trek fan. I think it's one of the most, maybe the most, not the most accessible behind... I think 2 and 4 are very accessible, and then I would say this one.
Easily the best Next Gen movie.
Yes. Yeah, no question. And I say this as somebody who doesn't hate Insurrection.
I don't think I hate any of them. If any Star Trek movie is on, I'm going to watch it. But yes. I was happy when you suggested First Contact, because I was like, okay, good, that's the Next Gen movie I really like. So that's what I thought. I probably haven't rewatched Insurrection or Nemesis or Generations in quite some time. Probably Generations most recently, probably because of the J.J. Abrams stuff, and I was probably on a Kirk kick and I wanted to watch it.
Right. Nemesis, I think, if memory serves, is my least favorite, and I was surprised that Insurrection landed at the bottom of the Screen Drafts draft, that everyone agreed it was the worst of the Star Trek movies.
I would put Nemesis below Insurrection.
I would as well, and I would also put Star Trek Into Darkness probably below both of them.
Benedict Cumberbatch's presence kind of skews it for me because I'm a huge Sherlock fan, but...
Does it, though?
Not enough to put it. No, I don't think so. No, I do not enjoy Into Darkness. I think it's a very angry and shitty remake of Wrath of Khan. But, you know, I love me some Sherlock, so it skews me a little. But, no, I agree with you. Carry on.
So, anyway, that was what made me want to revisit First Contact for this podcast. But what is your relationship to First Contact?
So I grew up a huge Next Gen fan. My grandfather, on my mother's side, my mom's dad, and my uncle watched it a lot. So when I was a little, you know, through the early 90s and the mid and late 90s and stuff, I watched it a lot with them. And then Friday nights, I would go to my dad's, and my dad was a big Mystery Science Theater fan and a big Star Trek, Next Gen fan. So we would invariably on a Friday night watch MST3K and probably some Star Trek as well, or he would watch it with friends on Saturday afternoon and I would watch it with them. So I grew up not necessarily on TOS, but I came to that later. But Next Gen was definitely a big part of growing up. I was actually looking for, I had to call my mom. I was looking for my, I think when I was probably 7 or 8, I went as Data for Halloween one year.
Nice.
Because we had gone to a Star Trek convention and I got a tricorder and a phaser. And there's a picture somewhere of my mom applying makeup to make me look like an albino man made of plastic. And you know me, I'm of the darker Italian complexion, so it was pretty difficult. But I remember being very proud of my Data. And I think it says a lot about me that of all the Next Gen cast, I chose to go as Data.
Because you long to be more human.
Every day. I want someone to patch skin onto my exoskin, which we'll get into later. I've seen all of Next Gen a bunch of times. I've seen the original series. I've made it about halfway through Voyager, to no fault of Voyager's own. It's just, for whatever reason, I just didn't get through it. I've never seen Enterprise, Discovery, or Deep Space Nine. So I'm sort of a Star Trek person. I've seen all the movies, but not enough to really speak with any expertise about anything that comes sort of after Next Gen, for the most part. So I grew up with Next Gen. I don't remember how I felt about First Contact when I saw it, but what was it, not to throw it back on you, but was it First Contact that made you want to go back and watch TNG? You said you hadn't grown up with it or hadn't really watched it.
Yeah, I think so. And at that time, you know, the DVDs weren't out or anything, so you just had to be lucky to catch it in syndication. It wasn't really until the DVDs came out that I started to be able to actually watch entire seasons of it. And, of course, Netflix has made that incredibly easy. I don't know what I'll do if – and I own most of the physical copies of the shows. I don't own Deep Space Nine. But I own basically all the other series, and yet I still only watch them on Netflix.
Well, you know, in that case, it is a case of convenience, and there's nothing, I don't think Netflix does anything drastic to the series itself. I don't think, right? Because sometimes there's like cropping issues and
No.
Yeah. Last year, I think Hulu put up a HD transfer of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which made Buffy fans go crazy, because it was cropped in a weird way, and it changed some things around. Obviously, we have all these Disney Plus problems, so we still can't trust streaming all the time. But I was watching a couple episodes of it earlier today, and it seemed okay on Netflix.
Yeah, they're showing the HD transfers of Next Generation, which is nice. So this was kind of what got me more into Next Generation. Voyager is still the one I have the least experience with. I've probably seen 2 episodes of Voyager in my life.
I think I've seen the first season, and that might be it.
Okay.
No judgment against it. I'm sure.
Yeah, right.
I just haven't gotten to it yet.
We just started watching Discovery. I haven't seen any of Star Trek Picard, but last Christmas, Erica bought me the first, because we don't have CBS All Access, but she bought me the first season of Discovery, and then this Christmas she bought me season 2, even though we had not yet watched season 1. So just took it out and started watching season 1. I'm only like 4 or 5 episodes in, and I'm enjoying it because it's Star Trek, but I will admit that like it's trying really hard to be dark.
Yeah.
And I'm not as big a fan of like dark Star Trek.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to get into this a little bit just before we even get into the movie, but just sort of the idea of, one of my questions for you was, how do you feel that Star Trek translates to movies? Because the series, especially with the Next Gen movies, the series Star Trek The Next Generation is very different than the movies of The Next Generation. And I think you could probably say the same thing about the original series, although it's a little different because of the time gap, I think, and with the original series and the original series as movies. So by necessity, it had to change a little bit. But do you feel like Star Trek, just in terms of the ideals and in terms of the vision and Roddenberry and stuff, do you feel like that's been successfully translated to film? Because I know there's a lot of people who would say it really hasn't yet, because of the nature of Star Trek being sort of more cerebral and less kind of whiz-bang and more about exploration and discovery, and not necessarily about, like, you know, third act plot turns and stuff that you need for, I mean, First Contact is full of that stuff where it invents problems that the series wouldn't have.
Right.
But because it's a movie, we need to have, you know, this thing happen or that thing happen. So I was just curious what you thought about that.
I think the movies probably did more right by the original series. I think those movies have more in common with that show than the Next Generation movies have in common with the Next Generation. Oddly enough, I think in terms of translating the show, I think Insurrection is probably the closest in terms of, you know, it feels like kind of a middling episode of the show, right. But it's trying to deal with some ideas. I mean, First Contact is the best of the movies, but it's nothing like the show. It turns the show into an action movie.
Movie Picard is very different than the right. show Picard.
Like, he's Kirk. I mean, in First Contact, they make him into Kirk.
Movie Kirk is kind of different than show. I'm of course not the first Star Trek fan to bring this up. It's an ongoing question, especially after the J.J. Abrams stuff really dug in with the Star Wars DNA, which I don't mind. I don't like Into Darkness, but I like Star Trek 09. I like Beyond quite a bit.
Yeah, me too.
But I also feel like it's scratching a different itch. Like I watched First Contact last night, and then today when I got home, I was prepping for this, and I watched like Best of Both Worlds, the Borg episode where Picard is assimilated. I watched I, Borg, which is the one where they capture the Borg guy and they decide whether or not they're going to basically infect a virus to, you know, destroy all the Borg collective and stuff. And I was sort of comparing the moral quandaries of the movie with the moral quandaries of the show, and Picard is sitting
is there a moral quandary in the movie? The moral quandary is like, how quickly should I kill them all?
How quickly can I make them pay for, you know, right. how quickly can I get revenge? I mean, I at some point, you know, one of the writers read Moby Dick and was like, okay, he's Ahab. Like,
right.
Which, of course, is explicitly noted in the movie.
Right.
And again, that's that kind of thing where it's like, we need to create conflict. Like, one of the things that always makes me laugh about Star Trek movies is how they create interpersonal conflict when, like, Star Trek doesn't have interpersonal conflict. Like, the whole kind of idea is that it's this utopian, you know, peacekeeping force. It's this whole, I mean, there's disagreements among the crew, but like the way that, you know, Picard is suddenly screaming and firing assault rifles and stuff, it's just a little bit, you know, it's blown out of proportion for the movie. It has to be, you know, it has to fit the big screen. But it always makes me laugh whenever I watch a Star Trek, especially a next gen movie, because it is so patently different.
Right.
From the show, you know, right. which, and you know, good and bad. It's not necessarily, you know, I would rather watch an episode of Star Trek than a Star Trek movie, but I know people who would feel the opposite, and they're both good.
Yeah, you know, we're fortunate to have both.
Yeah,
I probably would rather watch an episode as well. I just think it works better this way. But I like you said, I like most of the movies, and would probably watch any of them.
Speaking of any of them, our first quiz break. Your favorite Enterprise? Go. What is your favorite version of the Enterprise?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, probably the original series.
Okay. All right. I'm more of an Enterprise D guy. I'm a next gen.
Okay.
I like the design of the Enterprise D. Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
Sure. Yeah. Here's a question about First Contact. Is it missing a first act?
It is.
I didn't remember this being the case, and then I put it on yesterday, and I was like, whoa, 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 wait a second. There's so much that's just handled with, like, offhand dialogue. Like, the notion that Earth, history has been rewritten, and Earth is now overtaken by Borg, is literally just a two-sentence line of exposition.
It's jumped over while they're in the time tunnel thing.
It's amazing to me that, like, that seems like a pretty big deal. That seems like, hey, we better fix that. And for it to just be sort of glossed over, I thought was very strange.
And, you know, and again, this speaks to the necessity of translating something like Star Trek, where, you know, every Star Trek episode, there's, okay, you know, Captain's Log, we're out here doing this, we're looking for this thing, oh, look at that thing, let's go investigate that thing, okay, there goes the away team, okay, it looks like the problem is getting deeper, Captain, what do we do? Well, let's have a debate about it for half an hour until the first commercial, and then blah, 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 and then there'd be some action-y thing at the end, and then they would carry on, right? The movie has to be like, no, fuck that, we're going, we're going, we're going, the Borg is attacking Earth right now. It's like, wait, Why? Wait,
I mean, the movie just opens with like, oh, hey, the Borg is back and they're attacking Earth and let's go back in time as though it's nothing.
But they go back. I looked away from the screen. They go back. It's like, oh, the Borg are going back in time. Let's follow them. Okay, great. Scan the Earth. Scan the Earth. Oh, shit. The Borg have taken over all the Earth. Okay. We'll follow them through the time tunnel. Oops, we're back in time to the 21st century. I was like, I looked away. I looked at my watch for a second and looked back. I was like, holy shit. What happened? When did we time travel? To go back and rewatch it again because I was trying to fix that plot point. But, oh, it's totally missing a first act. And that's kind of what the thing is. And, you know, one of my notes is like, Star Trek movies will by necessity always be dumbed down. I don't know if it's dumbing it down, but it's definitely like, get to the point, like skip to the end. Like,
it's so really, much. It wants to rush the setup. I mean, yep. We don't really get to like hang with any of the characters. And I recognize you're supposed to be coming into this movie familiar with the characters. You're supposed to know who these people are. And so we don't need to set them all up. But it would be nice to give 10 or 15 minutes of setup and that, you know, kind of the reveal that the Borg is back and the reveal that they're going back in time. And none of this stuff is revealed. It's all just sort of shouted at the screen. And then once the movie, like, once they do go back in time and the setup has taken place, then I'm okay with the pacing. Then I think the rest of the movie plays out, like, as a movie should. But I just think it's really missing some crucial stuff at the beginning.
And I'm wondering if that's, like, because I read a little bit and it was like, well, one writer wanted the time travel plot, the other writer wanted the Borg, and so they just kind of smushed them together, which is, you know, I mean, I know, I'd have to look at the other names. I know Ronald D. Moore was a writer on the movie, of course. Longtime Star Trek writer will go on to create the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, which is wonderful. So I trust Ronald D. Moore, but I was kind of like, I'm wondering which parts of this were whose, you know, who had this idea and that idea, and maybe the rushing to get to that inciting incident was kind of like, just don't worry about it. We're going. It's like the beginning of Rise of Skywalker. It's like, just go.
Rise of Skywalker.
Don't think about it. Don't look over there. Look over here. We're doing this. We're on a thing. Okay, let's go. You know, then that's the, you know, the Star Trek stuff that I like is not necessarily that, but I also feel like you can understand why they do it. You know, they get, then the first 5 minutes they're violating the Prime Directive and we're like, hold on a second. And there's a line literally where, you know, I think Crusher says like something like, oh, don't talk to me about the Prime Directive. And it's like, okay, we're hand waving that. We're moving on. You know, at the end of the movie, they hand wave the fact that they recreate the Borg's time travel technology without having a time travel device.
Right.
He turns to Geordi and he's like, recreate the time tunnel. And Geordi's like, got it, boss. Let's just keep going. No time to talk. No time for this Star Trek stuff. We got to get Data to bang the Borg Queen. By the way, does Data bang the Borg Queen?
Yes, he does.
Absolutely.
Data fucks. I just, hey, you know, because I've been rewatching season one, Data fucks Tasha Yar.
He does. Yeah, he has a lot of, you know, and it's Alice Krieg, who's wonderful, obviously.
She's hot as the Borg Queen.
She's great, man. She's a big part of my beloved Silent Hill, so I always love out me some Alice Krieg. Oh, that's right. Well, the movies are always so fascinated with Data because I think Data makes for a really good, like, he makes for a really good point of conflict if you have to dilute Star Trek into 2 hours. Like, I always feel like, one, you know, Brent Spiner is great in the part, obviously. But, like, so many of the movies sort of fixate on Data and what it means to be Data. And there's great episodes of TNG that do that, you know, Measure of a Man and things like that. But, like, the movies are always – they tend to be fixated on the meaning of Data and how giving Data as much – you know, he has a whole third storyline, you know, him by himself, basically, with the Borg Queen. Also, does the Borg Queen make sense?
No, not in comparison to what the Borg are.
And I know that the Borg Queen shows up in later series, and again, I have to plead ignorance. I know there are like Voyager episodes where the Borg Queen shows up, I think. And I know that the writers have basically, you know, rearranged some of the Borg mythology in later series after First Contact to incorporate a Borg Queen, but, you know, you see it as a narrative convenience. It's like, well, we need, it's like the Matrix, is it the Matrix Revolutions where all the robots make that big face? Because Neo needs something to talk.
Right. And I think they're sort of upfront with the fact that she is a narrative convenience.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're not, you know, they're upfront about it. They're not trying to hide it. But they do go back and, sort of change, best of both worlds a little bit, where Picard's like, oh yeah, you were always there, you know, which is fine. I'm not, you know, these are narrative cheats that movies and TV shows take all the time. I'm not complaining, but I was sitting there sort of scratching my head thinking like, wait, the Borg Queen doesn't really make a lot of sense. And they sort of hand wave around it. She's like, I am the Alpha and the Omega. And it's like, okay. All right. And then Data even says, like, I think, which is probably what you're getting at, which is like, oh, interesting answer. Doesn't answer my question,
right,
but interesting right. answer. Yeah. So it's sort of just hand waved away, just like everything else, you know, doesn't matter.
We like this movie.
We like this movie.
Yeah, no. I like this movie a lot.
I want to be careful here. And if I'm getting too critical of it, please stop me, because I like this movie. But yeah. We also have to be honest and address, like, okay, you know, this takes some leaps. Anyway.
My other, if I have a major complaint about the film, besides the fact that it's missing a first act, is that, as you said, it does seem to be primarily interested in Data and Picard and yeah. really no one else. And so we don't get, you know, the nice thing about, in particular, I think the J.J. Abrams movies, but I think that some of the original series movies, in particular Part 4, were good about was giving everyone something to do, giving the entire ensemble sort of moments where they get their little bit to shine. And this movie doesn't really have that, you know. You would almost not know, except for maybe the scene where Troy is like drunk at the bar. She has nothing to do. Crusher has nothing to do. Geordi has nothing to do.
I would argue Geordi has a little bit more to do, because at least he's working on the spaceship, but I agree that he's got very little to do.
The big change to Geordi is he's not wearing his visor. I mean, that's like his big character development.
And I'm wondering, do you think that's in spite of or because of the fact that Jonathan Frakes is directing the film? Maybe he didn't feel, I mean, he's directed episodes of the show, so it doesn't seem like maybe he'd be uncomfortable directing while acting, but maybe in diluting down some of the other cast parts, he was kind of like, well, let's just keep it on the three main, you know, keep it on Picard, Data, and the development of the ship. I don't know.
I feel like it's at a screenplay level, you know, that the focus was, because again, you know, proof that like 2 and 4 are the best entries in the Star Trek franchise, this movie basically combines 2 and 4. This is like, hey, what if we did Wrath of Khan and Voyage Home? So we get half time travel and half revenge plot with the most famous character from the most famous villain from our show.
Except Picard is kind of Khan.
A little bit, yeah.
No, totally agree. Yeah. And I also agree that 2 and 4 are the best movies. I love me some space whales. So I'm looking through my notes here. Does Data fuck the Borg Queen? Yes, he does.
Yeah, for sure he does.
You know, and if I could throw in a little bit of defense of the Data stuff, I mean, the movie is obviously sort of about what it means to be human, and, oh, you know, the 21st century guys, the Zefram Cochrane's crew, are sort of, you know, these are primitive people, and then in Seeking Revenge, Picard is sort of, you know, regressing back to that sort of 21st century mindset. He needs to remember that he's a being of the 24th century that's more enlightened, and then the Borg have no personality whatsoever, and they're a big collective, and all that stuff kind of gets mashed together. Right. And Data is an interesting conduit to that, and the whole idea of him lying to the Borg Queen and stuff. So it sort of hangs together, you know, but I agree that the fascination with Data definitely takes, you know, I could use a little bit more Riker mugging, you know. I could use a little bit more Geordi, you know.
The Data stuff is way worse in Nemesis, and that's because I want to say Brent Spiner was a writer on it. But that movie has a preoccupation with Data that it does not earn, and turns Data into that's Wrath of Spock or Wrath of Khan for, you know, it's Wrath of Khan Spock, except it's Data, and it does not earn it.
Do I need to go back and watch Nemesis?
I mean, sure, if you want to see Tom Hardy play a clone of Patrick Stewart.
And who doesn't?
Going back to the Borg Queen real quick, Roger Ebert wrote, while the Queen looks like no notion of sexy I've ever heard of, I'm inspired to keep an open mind. Which is pretty right on.
That's very Ebert. I actually just finished reading Life Itself. Finally, I finally got around to reading it, and that sounds very much like his sense of humor. That's pretty funny. Favorite Star Trek theme song? Original series? Next Gen?
I think it's...
09?
I like the Giacchino score for 09.
Me too.
That's a tough one. Because my heart is with the original series, but I do really like the Next Generation theme song.
I'm going Next Gen,
okay.
followed by 09.
Wow, putting the original series dead last.
Well, it's not dead last because there's Voyager and all those other shows.
Oh, yeah,
they have sort of innocuous kind of themes that are just sort of general symphonic sounds. I don't really connect with any of those.
No.
The three that I really connect with. And also, it's got to be said, like, it's kind of like Batman where it's like, oh, well, you know, I have one franchise that has three really good themes, you know? So none of them are, I like all three.
Discovery is the worst, by the way.
I have not even heard it, I don't think.
If you put a gun in my head, I couldn't tell you. Like, there's barely a theme. Like, whatever. It's just a series of noises.
Did the Borg decide to time travel before or after they were going to Earth, do you think? When did the Borg decide they were going to time travel? Do they just have that in their back pocket all the time?
Yeah, it seems weird to just now pull that out. If they have the technology.
I mean, Star Trek has always played fast and loose with time travel. It's not, you know, there's 15,000 things in Star Trek that are about time travel, but like you would think the Borg would have used this.
Right. I think before they decide to go to Earth, right? Because they decide to go to Earth and then decide to stop first contact from happening.
And I'm not, I like this movie. I'm also just fascinated by it.
I do like the decision to have the time travel stuff is kind of just like, oh yeah. And also time travel. It's not like part four where it's such an integral part of the story. And like a big deal is made out of the fact that we're traveling through time, which they had done on the original series, obviously in probably the most famous episode. But, the time travel is kind of a throwaway, but I do like the decision to have them travel back to the moment of first contact because it is obviously such a key moment in Star Trek lore. And while James Cromwell is not the first person to play Zefram Cochrane, he is certainly the most memorable to ever play Zefram Cochrane. And that's kind of the way that I remember the character is James Cromwell's characterization of him. So I think it's a really cool storytelling decision, even though there's virtually no conflict on the Earth storyline.
It is very strange that everybody on Earth goes through the entire movie not knowing that the Borg have taken over the Enterprise.
Right.
Like, I was reminded of that at the end when they're on the Phoenix and Riker's like, he sees the Enterprise, like, oh, just giving us a send-off. And I'm like, oh, shit, they have no idea what's going on.
Right.
Which is, again, not an uncommon Star Trek trope. Like, they lose contact with the Enterprise all the time. It made me laugh. I was like, oh, shit, that's right. This is crazy.
There's not really even a moment where, like, the DeLorean won't start, you know? It's literally just like, hey, we're going to help him make first contact. And then they do.
I guess Zefram Cochrane has that, like, I don't want to be a hero thing, which I like the whole, his thing about the statue, which is, you know, kind of fun and... Again, kind of fits into that Star Trek lore. I like Geordi's line about how he went to Zefram Cochrane High School, which is fun. Geordi's fun. I'm a LeVar Burton fan. Not only just because
he's always great. I love him.
Yeah. He taught me to read and also taught me how to wear visors on my face.
Also taught me to feel.
Oh, yeah. Geordi is my friend. speaking of Geordi is my friend, can we talk a second about Picard and his rage? So, I like this for the movie. But isn't it strange that there's been all this time between when he was assimilated and all the things that he's dealt with since then, including, you know, that episode where he brings the Borg into the Enterprise. They decide not to infect him with the virus and send him back to the collective, you know, sort of peacefully. I guess this is a bad question because you saw the movie first. I was wondering if you thought it was odd that they went back to that plot point of like, by the way, Picard hates the Borg. Like, do you think it serves a good enough? Like, do you think it's a good enough point of conflict considering the show and the movies?
I do, because again, as I watched the movie, I forgot about the episode where I forgot about Iborg.
Got it.
So in my memory, it was like Best of Both Worlds, right?
Yeah.
And then this. So it makes sense to me that, like, he's still carrying a grudge against the Borg. And I like that, like, he's a pretty peaceful guy, pretty measured, pretty controlled, but, like, loses his shit when it comes to the Borg because he just really hates them. Like, I think all that works, even though it does seem out of character for him.
How do you feel, to move to a positive, how do you feel about the holodeck scene? Because I love a good holodeck scene. There's never a bad excuse for a holodeck scene. It's like the studio's like, hey, we've got some medieval knight outfits. We've got some 40s film noir clothes. You going to use these for anything? Cool. Let's have a holodeck scene.
Yeah. It's fun that they brought it to the big screen, you know?
Is this the only movie of – how many of the Star Trek movies have a holodeck scene?
I couldn't say offhand because I don't remember the other ones well enough.
Me neither. Yeah, no.
I could say, yeah, this is the only one, but somebody listening is like, absolutely not. They do one in every single movie. So
yeah, I'm not remembering. I'm pointing out that I love the holodeck. Yeah. I love him as – what is his name? Dixon – oh, shit.
Yeah, I don't remember.
What's his private eye name? I can't remember. Star Trek fans are flipping out right now. anyway, sorry.
The holodeck scene is fun. You get a little Neelix cameo from Voyager.
Robert Picardo, too, is in this
movie. He shows up earlier, which is always weird. There's a few, because I know Janeway shows up in one of the other movies.
Oh, shit, does she?
She does.
I'm sure she does. I just
And supposedly... I could be wrong about this. What's his name from Deep Space Nine? Oh my God.
Sisko?
I could not think of his name. I kept wanting to call him Hawk, which is his name on Spencer for Hire. there's a Hawk in this movie though. So that maybe that's why I'm getting so confused.
That might be it.
Supposedly he had scenes shot that were cut with Worf.
Like, well, see, that would make sense because Worf comes flying over from Deep Space Nine, like just like, you know, prepare for ramming speed. And I'm like, oh shit, there's Worf, you know, wonder what he was doing.
Right. And he does get a couple moments. I had said none of the rest of the cast gets any moments, but actually Worf does get a few, and not just assimilate this, but his fight with great. It is, although in my memory, it was cooler. In my memory, because I hadn't seen this movie for a number of years, and rewatching it, my memory was him saying assimilate this, and then he shoots and kills a Borg, but he just like shoots a satellite dish that's floating away. Like, it's not as cool.
A satellite dish that they already shot once.
Right, exactly.
And then they said they couldn't.
Not as cool, but I mean, still a cool line. I just wish that he had said it, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
No, Worf rules. Michael Thorne is pretty great. You like, I guess, as fans of things, we like when it's kind of the Mark Hamill rule where it's like, we like when the person likes being in the thing, you know, it's like the Barbara Crampton, you know, it's like you like when it's not just a job.
Right.
You know, and obviously, you know, a lot of the Star Trek cast is that way, but notably, you know, some aren't, you know, you've got your Harrison Fords of the world and stuff who are kind of like, this is dumb. But then again, it makes like, one of my friends has a great line about Han Solo, which is Han Solo was only cool because he thinks Star Wars is stupid. You know, that's the coolest thing about Han Solo is he thinks Star Wars is stupid, which is totally right.
That's the opposite, though, of Michael Dorn and Worf, who like buys into it 150%, and that's what makes him so great.
Exactly. Yeah, Michael Dorn is great.
Everybody's great. Again, I would have taken Wesley Crusher in this movie. I'm fine with it. Bring him in.
Tasha Yar, bring her back.
Bring her back. She does come back on the show.
How do you feel about the line that Zefram Cochrane has about how they're on some kind of
Star Trek? I wanted to bring this up because I definitely threw up in my mouth. Like, I'm not a huge fan of movies going out of their way to invoke the title. But when they're trying so hard to invoke something as iconic as Star Trek, it's...
As if Trek is a word we use casually.
Right. It was definitely an eye-rolling moment for me.
What's really funny is that I watch most things with subtitles on, and I the subtitle popped up before he said it, and I was just like out loud. I was like, oh, no.
Nope. Cut it out. Yeah. Put Sisko's cameo back in the movie and cut that line.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's that's kind of how we got off on this tangent. Was it's kind of weird when they bridge some of these series together. Because again, if you were not a Star Trek fan, you would have no idea what that Robert Picardo cameo is doing in the movie. They're like, right. We need a distraction. And they summon up a bald man. Like, what the fuck is this supposed to be? And I'm sure I thought that when I saw this movie in 96, because I wasn't watching Next Generation, much less Voyager. Like, none of that made sense to me. It's short enough that you're just like, whatever, I'll roll with it. But, now, you know, as somebody who has watched the show and is much more of a Star Trek nerd, I like shit like that. Now I'm like, hee hee, fun. There's the Doctor. But yeah, at the time, I'm sure it made no sense to me.
Especially when you see when the film starts and you see that they're all in the new uniforms, which are that's Voyager era or Deep Space Nine era. Uniforms. I think, right? It's the brown, the darker ones.
Yeah.
Aren't they? Wasn't it Voyager?
I didn't think so.
I don't remember. Anyway, the Enterprise, when they're on the Enterprise E, and it's like, oh, look, they've got sort of more cinema. You can always tell when they shift Star Trek stuff to the cinema.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like the sets are lit differently and stuff, and the uniforms are a little bit more detailed, you know, and stuff like that. What do you think about Frakes as a director? Because he's directed a whole shit ton of Star Trek.
Yeah, I think he acquits himself very nicely. I think the movie feels appropriately cinematic. I think it's one of the more cinematic Star Trek movies. Yeah, I think he does a really impressive job for this being his first time directing a feature and a not inexpensive one at that. They spent a good chunk of money on this movie, and I think it shows.
Yeah, it's his instincts are good. I think that they just, you know, reading and just by just nature of assumption, you know, they obviously wanted to go with somebody who understands Star Trek. And it is kind of interesting considering, you know, obviously in the original series, they had Nimoy and Shatner take turns directing. Right. And, you know, with mixed results, obviously, although, you know, Star Trek V is you can watch it if you're watching all the Star Trek movies. How do you feel about Star Trek V?
I don't think it's as terrible as some other people.
I got probably, I think 2 years ago, I got the Blu-ray set of the original movies, and I just watched them all the way through, and I didn't notice a significant dip in quality, but probably because I was watching like 3 Star Trek movies a day at the time. So, but it is interesting that they would go back and kind of allow a cast member to do it. But yeah. I think they, if anyone, think they picked the right one, because I mean, I'm just looking through his credits, and I mean, boy, he did a lot. He did Insurrection. First Contact, he directed a lot of Voyager, directed some Deep Space Nine, obviously some TNG. He's directed some Discovery as well, and looks like 2 episodes so far of Picard.
Oh, wow.
This is his director credits, right? Yeah, I'm under director. Yeah, because obviously I know he's in Star Trek Picard, but yeah, he's directed, looks like 6 episodes of Discovery, 5 episodes of Discovery, 2 Picard so far. He's directed The Orville, which I've never seen.
The Orville, I've seen a few episodes of, and if you're a Star Trek fan, I actually really recommend it. It scratches that itch.
Am I going to have the Galaxy Quest problem where I'm comparing them? Is it a comedy?
Not really. Like, oh, okay. I think they didn't know how to market it, so it was like, it's a wacky Star Trek parody. But it's not. It's just actually a pretty straightforward version of Star Trek. With some comedy in it, but the episodes that I saw were actually pretty straightforward.
Okay.
And I was actually really impressed with it. It's a show that I would watch all of if I had the opportunity.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've never watched it, but I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's directed. I mean, he's working. Frakes is working all the time. I mean, he's directing tons and tons and tons of TV.
Yeah.
Like, you know, The Librarians, Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, NCIS Los Angeles. He's working.
Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah, good for him.
I didn't know he was in Star Trek Picard.
Yeah, there's a scene. I don't know if the episode has played yet. I know one of the trailers I saw he was in.
I haven't seen a trailer.
I think there's a trailer where one of the scenes is Picard, like, because I know Data, Brent Spiner's in it too.
Data's in it too?
I think he's in like a flashback or something. I have not seen Picard. I'm only seeing stills and trailers. But I know there's a scene where Riker shows up in Star Trek Picard.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. It says Marina Sirtis is on there. It says Seven of Nine is on there.
Yeah, I know that. So, okay,
Am
I wrong about that? I'm almost positive.
No, you're right. I need to watch Star Trek: Picard. Is what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying. And I'm confused. They're in the middle of the series, right? Like it doesn't drop all at once like Netflix.
Correct.
It's like it's actually doing a TV show thing, which is cool. Keep doing that, streaming TV shows.
Yeah,
doing the TV show thing, where you release an episode every week.
Three have come out. The fourth will come out like the day after this episode drops, and that's the first one that Jonathan Frakes directed.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I mean, you know, he's working. Obviously, something is going right for him because he's had a long, healthy career.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think he does a really good job with this. I think it's a well directed movie.
How did you feel about the Lily role? I can't remember the actress's name now.
Elfrey Woodard.
Alfre Woodard, yeah. What do you think about that? Because she's kind of there as the sort of, you know, she's the plot point. She's the
right
character to bounce off of. She's the, if you're a West Wing fan, she's the Donna Moss. You know, she's the character who's there so that people can explain things to her, you know. Interesting that they didn't go with Zefram Cochran for that, but obviously, you know, I'm more characters the better, but and they're in two different places. But it is interesting. Her sort of relationship with Picard seems like it's going to, not romantically, but like it's going to have a little bit more of a flux to it. But really, it's just that one. It's the Captain Ahab scene, and that's about it. Because when they say goodbye to each other at the end, he's like, oh, you know, you mean a lot to me. And so I was like, oh,
When did that happen?
Again, Star Trek. Just keep going. Just skip over that part. Yes, 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 Commander. Go. Make it so. Yep.
No, I think she works. I mean, I think, again, like the Borg Queen, I think she's there to fill a specific narrative function. But if you're going to try to fulfill a narrative function, you could do much worse than Elfrey Woodard,
totally,
who at least humanizes the role and makes her very believable. And, you know, again, going back to me seeing this movie in 96, that was probably a very necessary function because she does help with the uninitiated. She is sort of the audience surrogate for those who are maybe not familiar with this world or who these characters are. And so, I think she does a good job of that. I know I read that originally Picard was supposed to be down on Earth doing the Zefram Cochran stuff and Riker was supposed to be the one fighting the Borg, but at Patrick Stewart's insistence, they flipped roles.
I feel like you can't have Picard and the Borg in a movie and not have them. You know.
It doesn't make a ton of sense, no, because again, the whole driving force of the movie is his quest for revenge against the Borg, sort of his hatred of the Borg and his trying to, and Alfred Woodard is a big part of that. She's sort of his conscience, whispering in his ear and sort of bringing him back down to Earth and making him find his humanity again, you know?
And I like that. I like that the thrust kind of goes back to, you know, we can laugh about how far away the movies stray from the TV show, but it really does kind of come back to Roddenberry's original sort of utopian vision. Like the idea of even the Enterprise crew kind of getting lost in all these conflicts and stuff and then remembering how all this started to begin with, you know, talking about Zefram Cochran's first, you know, his first warp flight and all that and how everything changed and how everybody can be better and explaining, you know, Picard has that scene where he's walking Lily through the Enterprise. And he's talking about how there's no money in the future and how, you know, goals are different and our society is different. And then Zefram Cochran talks about how he just wants to build a ship for money. And, you know, there's lots of stuff going on in there that I feel like is very, you know, it's in the spirit of Star Trek. Even if the, you know, it's sort of mounted on a movie that is maybe not necessarily doing what a lot of Star Trek TV shows episodes would do.
Right.
But you get a lot of the thematic thrust anyway, you know, sort of reminding these so-called primitive people what the future will.
Right.
Boy, I hope be like.
Yeah. I appreciate the fact that they do try. It's not just, they don't just turn it into an action movie. You know,
no,
they don't completely forget. And that's, I like the J.J. Abrams movies. I think Beyond tries to have some ideas. It comes closest to feeling like an episode of the show. As much as I like Star Trek 2009, it's just an action movie, you know?
Yeah, it's a slide. You're going down a slide, you know? and that's fun because going down slides is really fun.
But this one, at least, is an action movie that then is like, oh, wait, but we also have to be a Star Trek movie. So let's try to be about something greater. And I think they do enough of it to work.
Do you think what do you think of the queen, the Borg queen and the Data scenes? Like, do you feel
they're hot?
Do you like the Poe fucks? Do you think all the Borg feel it when the queen fucks?
I assume so. That's how Borg works.
Did Data do it with the entire collective?
Did she put the skin on before they fucked or after?
Well, it's not the only skin she put on.
Exactly.
Ayo.
Actually, wasn't the skin like a trade for fucking her? Wasn't it like, hey, if you do this, I'll give you skin. I'll make you human.
I think the skin was first, right? Because isn't there there's the joke, there's the sex joke first, right? Because she says, like, was it good for you too or something?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just when she blows on the arm.
Yeah.
And then later, you know, never mind. But yeah, no, I think the one thing we're really not talking enough about is how, you know, Data fucks the entire Borg collective. That just occurred to me.
Literally, actually, at the end of the movie by lying to them. And
Then he gives a good resistance is futile. His resistance is futile is good. I like his delivery. And then I like the way he turns and just smashes the smoky thing. Like, it's just like so over the top.
And then the Borg queen just dissolves.
She dies. Like, she's got that nasty, like, she's got like a RoboCop death. Like,
yeah, she really does.
And then Picard,
her head rolls up the hood of the Enterprise, like, holy shit.
And then Picard goes over and snaps her Terminator neck.
Right?
And it's like, whoa.
Fuck you.
Yeah, not the way Data would.
Assimilate this.
Do you think Data had to go back, like, in the future, and Data had to think about, like, the time? Like, no one was ever as good as the Borg Queen. Like, every time after that, he met a woman or man or whoever. He was like, yeah, it's just not. I like when it's an entire collective. I don't feel, you know, the reverberations through the galaxy the way I was used to with her.
It's just not the same. He's not constantly same. Looking for the Borg now. Captain, I think it's the Borg. No, Data. It's just Romulans.
Yeah, but there might be Borg behind the Romulans. What if one of the Romulans is fucking the Borg Queen? Can't have that. He gets his speed fingers going.
Do you think he kept that, like, skull and spine piece?
Oh, yeah. It's in his quarters, definitely.
He's building his own Borg Queen again.
Yeah, it's a 24th century real doll.
By the way, I would totally have a real doll Borg Queen.
Oh, the Borg Queen. Make sure the skin is as slimy as possible.
Oh, God.
We have rounded the bend here.
I have to order 20 more real dolls that look like Borg just to set up around the room.
And they all have to watch.
Yeah, right. It's not Otherwise, it's not believable. I can't complete the illusion.
You have to make eye contact with them. This episode brought to you by Borg's fucking Andrew.
This episode brought to you by Real Doll.
Resistance is <evil. laughs>
Yeah, no, it's
speaking
true.
Of which, are the favorite Star Trek villain? That'll be my last question. Are the Borg among your favorite villains? Villain race. I should say race. Romulans, Klingons, Vulcans. I shouldn't say villain. I should say extra Earthling race.
I would have said Klingons, but honestly, they've been the villains so far in Discovery, and they're weirdly uninteresting. I do like the Borg because it uses the language of a zombie movie, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
They look cool, especially in the movie. They look cool. On the show, they didn't look so hot. But
the problem with the Borg is you can't overuse them, because once you overuse them,
right,
they start to kind of fall apart a little bit. But yeah, no, I like
literally,
I like the Borg
literally, they start to fall apart when you overuse them.
Zing!
I speak from experience.
Listen. You can never have too many Borg real dolls. It's a little bit extra, but it's worth it.
Are you sure, sir? We have these Orion slave girl real dolls you might be interested in. No. Just the Borg.
Yeah. I need. Can you get me some of those skin attachments too? Because I need to complete the illusion. I've got a warp drive set in my basement. Really need to, bring this together.
Oh.
Bring this in for a sexy landing.
Yeah. Somewhere in the world, someone has done this, by the way.
Oh, for sure. Someone has done this. And they're like, bitches, I was doing this in 96.
Right.
We're talking about it now. Late to the party.
Who is your favorite villain race?
I think in the original series, I like the Romulans a lot. I think the Romulans are cool. I would say probably, to me, the Borg stands out to me the most for Next Generation because they were very iconic and I was very young when I was watching it. So like when I think Next Gen, I think Borg, so it's kind of just, it's the easiest connection to make, but it's the one I kind of like the most. No, I like the Borg. I like the idea of the Borg. I like the, which again, the Borg Queen kind of messes with a little bit, but overall, I think that the effect is still really cool.
You know who I don't really like is Q.
Oh, okay.
I don't find Q very interesting. And again, I'm rewatching the series, and I'm fewer than 10 episodes in, and they've already gone back to Q twice.
So he's kind of, so if I'm remembering correctly, Q is kind of the Joker of the Star Trek universe. Like he's kind of like the moral, he's the one who sort of throws monkey wrenches into their morality, right? Like
he's like the Loki.
Yeah. Well, okay. There you go.
The trickster.
He's the trickster. He's the one constantly sort of saying like, hey, don't do that good thing. Do this bad thing. I can see a little bit of a Q allergy. Definitely. Again, I'd have to really dig into a rewatch and kind of judge it because it's been a couple years since I've done a rewatch, except for those couple episodes I was watching. I can see that. What is it? Is it the actor or is it just you? Just
no, the actor is fine. I'm maybe just not super interested in characters who are all powerful.
Better or worse than Tasha Yar?
I don't mind Tasha Yar.
I'm looking up the name of that doctor.
Oh, it's very frustrating. Thank you for looking this up.
I gotta look it up. Hold on.
Because I'm not really a fan.
I don't think... Well, it was also because it was so sort of unceremoniously that she was like, yeah, I'm here now.
Right.
Okay, bye.
Exactly. Beverly Crusher who?
Yeah.
Not that I'm like exactly. A huge... I'm not even like all in on Crusher, but I don't know. I'll take her over this other doctor. God damn it.
Catherine Pulaski.
Yes.
Pulaski?
Yes.
Now, that sounds like a Twin Peaks character. No, yes. Yes, Commander Pulaski.
Yes.
Yeah, she sucked.
Yeah. Was that like season 2?
I want to say that was probably season 2 because I think Gates McFadden left for like one season, right? And then she came back. I clicked on the wrong thing. It sent me to Amazon. Do you ever notice lately that sometimes when you click on things in Google, you'll click on like Wikipedia and it'll just send you to Amazon?
I weirdly wound up on the Real Doll site. I don't know what happened.
Resistance is futile, Patrick.
I thought I was clicking on Wikipedia. But I just got to place an order real quick.
Make sure the drop-down box, make sure you get the skin attachment. Make sure you get the drill attachment that goes on the arm.
Oh, jeez.
That's the good one.
Yes, Pulaski. I was not a fan of Pulaski.
No. And she was just... I don't even think they wrote her off, right? Didn't she just...
No, I think Crusher just came back.
They
was
came
like,
back for the next season and Crusher was just there again?
Get out of my chair.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was about that. Anything else you want to say about First Contact?
No, I'm just going to do my best not to Google Borg and sexy at the same time for the rest of the evening.
Oh, God. And, there's going to be like weird, like, what are they... It's not slash fiction, right?
Yeah, I think so. Slash fiction is where you have like it's this character slash this character.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
So it can be any two characters. It's not only when it's like two characters of the same sex.
Oh no, I don't think so.
Okay. I don't know why I thought it was.
No, I haven't read any.
It's
slash
like when the two
since,
supernatural brothers fuck each other. Like whoa,
right.
Wow. Okay.
Since the Buffy the Vampire Slayer days, but.
You've read some? I've never actually read it.
I've read some Willow and Spike slash fiction in my time. I'm not going to deny it.
Two characters I was always wishing would get together.
I had a thing for Allison Hannigan,
Well, sure, but why Spike?
I don't know, because he was blonde. And Who knows? Angel just broods.
Yeah. Not Spike, though.
Not Spike. Spike doesn't brood. He rocks. Anyway, this has been your Buffy the Vampire Slayer minute in the middle of your Star Trek podcast that ended with us talking about Data fucking the Borg Queen.
Yeah, that's the most interesting part of this movie.
I agree.
A movie that I want to remind everyone we like.
We really like this movie.
I'd put it in my top five of all the Star Trek movies, and certainly it's my favorite of the Next Generation movies.
Oh, sure, easily. Yeah, yeah, might be, yeah, top five for me, because I got to think about the JJ movies. I would probably put 2 and 4, and Beyond would go above this for me. 09 is just so fun. Like,
it is really fun.
So it would definitely probably, this would probably be 5 on my list, yeah.
I would need to rewatch 6.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember 6 being good.
6 is good. No, I can't go down that thread because I don't remember enough about it. Okay. Yeah, no, I like... what do you think of the motion picture?
I've only seen it once. I would need to rewatch it.
Okay, yeah. I remember liking it the most I've ever liked it the last time I watched it, which was probably when I got that Blu-ray set.
Okay.
As a kid, because it's so slow. It's so, you know, cerebral. So I
never saw it as a kid. I only saw it sometime in the last 10 years was the first time I saw it.
That was a VHS. I remember that was a... rental. So copying, I remember black tapes, you know, my grandfather who owned a video store, would make me copies of his rental copies of things.
Right.
You know, he wasn't supposed to do that, but he did it anyway. And I remember having the motion picture on, like, it's one of those like memories where I remember the white tag and his handwriting,
nice.
Like Star Trek motion picture, you know, I had a lot of tapes like that. They're all somewhere now. I don't know where they are, probably gone. But, yeah, that was one of those. But I remember not really watching it that much because I was like, oh, that's the boring Star Trek. But nobody fucks a Borg in that one. Although, well, no, that one's kind of about fucking, though, because it's about the...
It is, V'ger.
V'ger goes through the thingy, yeah. All right, see? We're all bringing it back.
Yeah. A lot of Star Trek movies are about fucking.
Yeah, which is...
Kirk fucked those whales.
He totally fucked those whales.
Shatner has to do it. All right, well, thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you, Rob, for talking about this movie with me. Hopefully, if you're a giant Star Trek fan, we didn't make your head explode too much with all the shit we got wrong.
Sorry.
It's that risk that we run, unfortunately. But please do remember, March 7th, save the date for F This Movie Fest 2020. You can find our website at fthismovie.com. Follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. Listen, rate, review, subscribe in iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
The Borg Queen fucks.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.